Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth. My name is Lauren Litton and I am the host of the show. Spotlight on Youth is dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. It is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149, and you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question. You'll be placed in a queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. This is the first time we've had a show focusing on girls and juvenile justice. Until recently, there was little research to explain national trends that showed an increase in arrests for girls. We now know there are gender-based differences in offending and a pathways to delinquency. Here are a few facts, which I'm sure we will delve into more detail during the show. Girls enter the juvenile justice system at earlier ages than boys. They are detained for significantly less serious crimes than boys, and they remain in detention longer. Delinquent girls have higher rates of trauma and abuse than other girls their own age, with some research suggesting 7 out of 10 having experienced emotional, physical, or sexual violence. They are in need of gender-specific mental and physical health care, for example, due to pregnancy and higher rates of post-traumatic stress, attempts of self-harm or suicide than their male counterparts. All of this suggests a need to take a much closer look at what can be done to better assist girls on both the prevention and intervention continuums. Our guests today are from the Center for Girls and Young Women, which is part of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, which we're going to refer to as NCCD. The center is a passionate voice for activism to ensure equitable, humane, and gender-appropriate responses to improve outcomes for girls and young women. The center launched the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention's National Girls Institute, which provides a range of training, technical assistance, and resources to governments, communities, and organizations that serve at-risk and delinquent girls. Dr. Luanda Rivora is the founding director of the center and is a national expert, author, researcher, and trainer on issues specific to justice-involved girls and young women. She is often invited to testify at U.S. congressional hearings and is leading the Justice for Girls campaign. Luanda authored Girl Matters, a training of trainers curriculum, the state of Florida's blueprint for action, and co-authored the Savvy Sister curriculum. Before coming to NCCD, she served as the president and CEO of PACE Center for Girls, Inc., a statewide not-for-profit organization that provides gender-responsive, comprehensive educational, therapeutic, and transitional support services. And she worked as the director of program services for the National Network of Runaway and Youth Services in Washington, D.C. Dr. Rivora holds a doctorate in public administration, a master's in allied health, and a bachelor's in sociology. Vanessa Patino-Lydia is a senior researcher at the center. Her research interest focuses on the juvenile justice system's response to girls and minority youth, policy development, organizational assessment, and capacity building. She's particularly interested in bridging the gap between research and practice. Her work has contributed to such publications as The Children of Incarcerated Parents, Process Evaluation, and Rallying Cry for Change Florida Girls Profile Study. She also assisted with the development of gender-specific version of NCCD's Juvenile Assessment and Intervention System. She previously served as a project manager of the PACE Center for Girls Evaluability Assessment and Documentation of their gender-responsive model, as a research assistant at the Neighborhood Justice Center, and as a juvenile court case manager. Vanessa received both her bachelor's in criminology and master's in public health administration from the Florida State University. So, welcome, ladies, to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Luanda, maybe we can start with you. I provided a bit of background, but maybe you can be more specific about why NCCD launched the Center for Girls and Young Women.
The Center for Girls and Young Women was launched specifically to respond to the growing number of girls who were entering the juvenile justice system. We wanted to increase awareness around the disparate treatment of girls, as well as some of the abusive practices that were taking place inside of institutions. When we launched the center, we also recognized a critical need to address the misconceptions about the profile of girls. Who is a girl offender? And we wanted to set the facts straight. In launching the center, we also wanted to provide training and to provide technical assistance around creating gender-responsive programming and to challenge the status quo, these corrections model programs that we saw were further victimizing and re-traumatizing girls. And during that time, when we launched the center, we also wanted to inform the policy debate that was happening at the national level and to create some national momentum to spearhead reform and to make sure that the voices of girls and young women who had lived experiences in the juvenile justice system were being heard.
Terrific. So I mentioned a little bit of the research, and you're talking about this national dialogue. What has the research demonstrated for the reasons that girls experience delinquency and also the impact of their treatment or experience with the juvenile justice system?
Well, I think it's important first for people to understand sort of the trends and the profile of the girls in the juvenile justice system. In the introduction, we spoke a little bit about, you know, they're committed for lesser offenses than boys. So when you look at, like particularly in 2010, if you look at the data, girls are committed for status offenses. It's actually 11% compared to 3% for boys, and for technical violations, 22% versus 16%. And often they remain in the placements for longer periods of time because there are fewer residential placements available for girls. And so taken together, these sort of disparate practices have long-term outcomes for girls. What we've seen is, if you look at the sort of the, what are the pathways that are getting girls into the system, we know that the girls are arrested at younger ages. They come with histories of abuse, trauma, and victimization, and as high as sometimes as 92% into the system. We know that they have higher mental health problems and depression, likely to suffer eating disorders, and negative body image, and low self-esteem. When we did our rallying cry study in Florida, where we actually interviewed 319 girls across the state, we found that the major factors that were contributing to their delinquency revolved around family offenses and emotional and mental health factors. It was actually 79% emotional and health factors, 46% alcohol and drug abuse. And of the girls that were committed, 61% of them had offenses against family. And the one that you can talk about is kind of what that looked like with the offense against family.
The offenses against family is really an important part of this discussion when we talk about what the research is showing us, as well as the actual lived experiences of girls and young women. And one of the things that we're seeing across the country is with the change in the domestic violence laws, where there, in some states, there is a mandatory arrest if there's a preponderance of evidence when the police come that shows that hitting is taking place. And the intent of those domestic violence laws was around spousal abuse, with adults hitting one another. And certainly we support that from the Center for Girls and Young Women. But what we're seeing is the misapplication of those laws when there's mutual hitting happening in the context of a family. A family is fractured, there's a crisis, there's family disputes taking place, and sometimes the adolescent girl, is in a fight with an adult, whether it's a mother, a stepfather, a father, or whomever is in the house. When the police are called, the girl is more likely to be arrested when there's a preponderance of evidence that shows that hitting is taking place. Because from the perspective of the police officers, it becomes troubling when there's other children in the home, and if they remove the adult, then there has to be the dependency side getting involved with placement of the smaller children. And the girl also may continue to talk. She may be confronted with the police officer. But the need for really intervening in families and providing services that can help to address the disputes and the stressors inside of the family would be a much better response than charging girls with domestic violence or assault and battery, which then deep ends them into the juvenile justice system.
And by deep ending, I mean, I think an example of this that we heard from the girl's stories is, you know, their first contact with the juvenile justice system starts as, you know, a conflict at home often with mom or with mom's boyfriend that gets her involved in the juvenile justice system, often puts her on probation or sends her to secure detention. And then from there, the violations of probation and technical violations, and when she's sent to a program to get her the services that are not available in the community, she's sent to a residential program. And in that program, she often picks up additional charges, incidents. And so the issues are never addressed. The issues at home are not addressed. The conflict, the trauma she is likely to have experienced, her life histories of victimization remain unaddressed.
One of the young women that I talked to who was actually spending her young, precious life behind razor wire, she had been in the system for about 2 years when I interviewed her in a girls' youth prison. And I asked her what it is that she would want to say if she had an opportunity to talk to adults about what's happening with girls and what needs to change. And I think the quote from Maria is a sobering reminder for the adults who care about kids, who are advocating for change, to help inform our work. And what she said was, ask the adults to be there for us, to do what our parents couldn't do, be somebody we didn't have, be a friend. We don't have anyone to really talk to. That's where you can start to help us. Whether we are good or bad, I have no one, and I really try to be good, but I always mess up. And I think by listening to the voices of girls, we have an opportunity to address what's happening in the context of the home, helping families and parents to build their skills on how to deal with an adolescent girl and what they can do to really heal what's going on inside the family.
Well, I think that's a really nice segue into maybe you talking more about what your national needs assessment looked like, because you held, I think, something like 61 different listening sessions. So what did those voices tell you about what are some of the priority areas for us who work in the juvenile justice field? What are the resources and needs of girls, parents, and key stakeholders? And where are you as a center going to be focusing based on the information you gathered? I know it's a big question. So you can take whatever part, maybe some background on the needs assessment first.
Sure. So over the course of a six-month period, we conducted listening sessions across the country, and we really wanted to make sure that we heard from diverse voices, from diverse stakeholders. And to us, that meant not only listening to staff across the continuum, but also making sure that we included the girls who were involved in the system, as well as in prevention programs, as well as the parents and caregivers with daughters who had either previously been involved or currently involved. We spoke to a total of 607 stakeholders, 313 girls, 251 community stakeholders, and 43 parents. Like I said, we did that. It was a total of 61 listening sessions across the state, across the country. We divided it up into like rural, urban, suburban, and tribal. We listened we went into some of the tribal communities as well. And so what we were really trying to assess as part of the work with OJJDP for the national assessment is, so what are the training technical assistance and information needs of the stakeholders, and what should be the critical focus areas for the National Girls Institute based on that, based on what folks are saying. When we asked about training and technical assistance needs, the sort of common or the most common areas of focus from the stakeholders' perspective were mental health and trauma, abuse and neglect, pregnancy and teen parenthood, communication and relationships, and race and culture. They wanted both more information, they wanted best practices and resources, but they also wanted the skills component, which is how it's not just identification of mental health needs, but how do you actually work best with the girl in that context? And in terms of technical assistance, you know, it's the skills to inform their responses to girls when they often act out in programs, or how to just work with them, how to de-escalate behaviors in the facilities. And also just the issue of bullying and Facebook, the impact of social networking came up as well, just wanting to know the role of that and how to get more information.
And I'd like to share a little bit about the issue around Facebook and social networking. What we saw in some of the communities were girls were getting in trouble through posts that were happening on their Facebook pages, and their vigilance around monitoring the Facebook pages because of fear of what was being written about them. And then they would get into fights, particularly with other girls, around these posts, and which was getting them into the juvenile justice system. And when we talked with the girls, they talked about their fear, what was being written about them, how out of control that they felt, how they couldn't really talk to anyone in their community because they were really fearful it would get back on Facebook and then be blasted all over. And when we talked to the parents of the girls who were experiencing this, they were feeling helpless because they didn't know how to respond in this new technology. And when we talked to the teachers and the school personnel, they were talking as well about how it was being so disruptive within the school setting. And the girls saw positive aspects of Facebook and social media, but then they saw this downside that was creating the fighting, the in-girl fighting. So I think it's something for us to learn from. How can we use it in a positive way, and how can we teach girls to use Facebook in a way that doesn't hurt each other?
Sorry, Vanessa, were you going to say, it sounds like you're going to add something.
I was just going to, yeah. I guess, add to there's still more findings.
Yeah.
I mean, the Facebook was very interesting in that I think we went back and did a little bit of exploratory research to see, like, does it differ by gender? And what we found is, yeah, like, girls use Facebook more often. They check their pages more often than boys. They constantly looking at their pictures and, you know, reading what other people are posting about them. It was interesting to kind of look at the prevalence and then try to understand, you know, what could be some different outcomes, because social media or networking is not going away. it's a different part. I mean, it's this generation. So when we asked the parents about what it is that they needed, they really discussed sort of the issues happening at school, the need for more school support, prevention and intervention programs. They often said, you know, I know my daughter needs help. I don't know where to go. I don't know how to get her help. Everyone says you just need to call law enforcement. That's the only way you're going to get her help. It's like you have to wait that to that point. But there's nothing really available, or they don't know where to go. They did talk about people and services that they felt did have a positive impact, including social services, the counselors, and some of the court staff. when we asked them, this was an interesting sort of dichotomy that happened. We asked the girls, you know, what should adults focus on if they really want to help girls? And girls often talk about how sometimes the family conflicts were problematic, but they also, very important to note, they also said how integral and critical the family was to her support system. She wanted her family involved. She wanted to know how to talk with mom, had a better relationship with mom. And the parents echoed the same thing. They wanted to better understand their daughter. They wanted a language to talk to their daughter, you know, how to communicate. And then when we asked staff what are the problems, what are the challenges, they named the parents, the families as part of the problem. And so that was a really interesting finding about how sort of everyone sees it a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. And from a program perspective and an intervention perspective, we feel the need to really look at those differences, where the girls see their families as a source of strength, and the girls say things like, take the time to find out what's right about my family. I love my family. I wish someone understood that my mom needed help too. They're asking the adults who are working with them to invest in helping their families deal with whatever the trauma that's going on in the life of the family. And when we have staff who really see the family as the source of the problem, it creates a situation that we're not really meeting families and girls where they're at and providing interventions that are rooted in their life experiences and that takes into account the strengths that exist in those families.
Right. So I don't know if anything came out of the listening sessions from this. It was just sort of a question that was formed in my mind listening to both of you. Were there any themes that emerged for girls specifically that might be different than boys around their exposure to community violence? And also we had mentioned, you know, domestic violence earlier, but sort of their victimization maybe in dating relationships that also changes our thinking and approach to girls.
In terms of the listening session, which is the listening sessions and certainly what's backed by our practical experience with girls and what we see in the research, is that girls do suffer much higher rates of traumatic experiences, including abusive relationships, both in the context of family and in the context of dating relationships. And those relationships that should be safe spaces for girls, we know that we saw much higher rates of parental and family issues for girls more than we did for boys, and that programming has really got to take that into account.
And so you were just talking before my question, sort of what the approach needs to be more strength-based. And we keep using sort of gender responsive. We did have a question about what does that mean, and so maybe you can define sort of all those terms for us if you can.
And that's a really important question around what is gender responsive. And when we think about gender responsiveness, we want to look at being very deliberate in terms of creating programs and services that take into account the life experiences of girls, the developmental needs of girls, that also takes into account hiring staff who are specially trained to understand those experiences of girls. And we have to pay attention to the increased levels of trauma and victimization and how girls have a tendency, when they experience trauma, to internalize that pain or they turn inward. So we see higher rates of self-mutilation for girls. We also see higher rates of suicide attempts, although boys have higher rates of suicide completions because they use deadlier methods of suicide attempts. Girls have higher rates of suicide ideation. We see that girls have higher rates of eating disorders, and that really gets connected to the socialization of girls around trying to live up to some idealized body type. So when we talk about being gender responsive, we have to take into consideration how girls are socialized and help girls to really critically examine that socialization so that she can reject those images and that she can see her strengths and not deficits. You know, what we know about girls is up until about age 8, for girls in the general population, they're typically full of enthusiasm, they're willing to take risks. These are our girls in the earlier years. They do better on standardized tests than boys. They're typically more ready for school than boys. But at about age 8 or 9, something profound happens, and we see girls lose their self-esteem. We see girls start to internalize those socialization, the messages that they receive, that they're not good enough, or that it's more important to be pretty and pleasing to boys than to be strong and competent. So that gender socialization begins to impact their self-esteem and their self-concepts. So in creating a gender-responsive program, we have to take that into consideration and be very deliberate in how we create those programs to help girls to know their strengths and to be able to critically examine and reject some of those stereotypes.
And I think it's important, too, to mention that, you know, while we're looking at this through a gender lens, we have to also respect and honor within gender differences, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, just lived experiences, and what that means, and how you are gender responsive, and how, you know, it was interesting when we asked the girls, we asked them, what should staff get training on? What should be the top 3 areas? And we were expecting, I don't know why we were expecting them to give us topic areas, but they gave us like staff responses is what the theme came out. They wanted, it says, listen to me, learn how to communicate, respect me, understand what I've been through, understand my background, don't judge me, don't think you know me because of what you see on this paper, get to know me, understand my life story. So it's almost like they gave us the definition for gender responsiveness, because the field has struggled with coming up with what does that look like in practice.
And certainly one of the areas that we have to look at in practice is we have to take into account the importance of relationships and how girls relate to the world around them. And what we know about girls and women is that we center our lives around our relationships, and it's a critical developmental factor, certainly for both boys and girls, is to have this connection to others. But for girls in particular, the interventions have to take into account relationships, because it's in the context of her relationships and her connection to others where abuse takes place, where often it's the trauma and victimization that takes place in the context of these relationships. So we have to develop programs that really look at the complexity of those relationships, teach her how to be safe in relationships. And so that's why looking at this through the gendered lens, and as Vanessa said, making sure that we also honor those within girl differences, whether it is age, whether it is culture, whether it is sexual orientation, it's her lived experiences. But being deliberate and having gender as a organizing theme, whether it's in our programs, whether it's in our policies, and whether it's in our practices.
Well, I'd like to remind our listeners that they can call in if they have a question that they want to ask on air, and that phone number is 347-994-1149. And you'd press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question. We do have another question in the chat room, and then maybe we can turn to some of, you know, the implications of your findings, even though you've started on that. We have a question whether any of the states or federal statutes require that gender-specific services or responses take place in the juvenile justice arena.
Can you repeat that question?
Whether any of the states or federal laws require that gender-specific responses or services be built in the juvenile justice arena?
Yes, actually, the reauthorization of the OJJDP Act required that states provide gender-responsive services and that each state actually develop a plan for their juvenile justice system that would include how that they're going to integrate gender-responsive services. And there are a number of states that have enacted statutes that mandate gender-responsive services. Vanessa, I don't know if you recall all of the states. I know that Florida has
Florida,
one, Oregon.
Oregon.
Michigan.
I think
there's
four.
There's seven states and that actually require and have in their statutes a mandate for gender-responsive services.
Great. And just for our listeners who don't know what JJDPA is, that's the Juvenile Justice Delinquency and Prevention Act. So maybe we should start taking a look at some of the responses, the good, the bad, the ugly. So what's not working? You know, you talked about like the misapplication of domestic violence laws that were specific about, dynamics of an intimate partner relationship that many states have now expanded to family violence. And something that came to me when you were talking about that was it sounded like there might be even a different response by responders to girls' use of violence. So when girls are using violence versus boys, even if it's the same type of violence, that there is a harsher response, maybe based on our perceptions of girls using violence at all. It was just something that kind of occurred to me. So what can you tell us about what's not working right now?
Well, there's a lot of practices that's not working, and certainly when we start fundamentally with the fact that girls are being charged with far less serious offenses than boys, they are held in secure detention longer for less serious offenses. We see a disparate overuse of violations of probation, the technical violations of probation, more so for girls than for boys. And then when girls are locked up in confinement or in residential commitment programs, we see that although they have higher or lower disciplinary actions, they have higher rates of infractions. And again, it gets to that difference of how we won't tolerate any acting out for girls and we criminalize that behavior. And we also see the overuse of physical restraints for girls and young women who are inside of institutions. And our major concern around this arcane practice is that it is re-traumatizing and re-victimizing girls who have such high rates of trauma and victimization. And we still have states across this country who shackle girls during labor as well as women when we have pregnant girls who are inside of institutions and they are giving birth. They are shackled because there is this fear that they're going to run away. And for anyone in the audience, I'm sure, who has experienced labor and birth, this practice is something that absolutely should stop. It puts the girls at risk and it puts her baby at risk. And so those are some of the practices that we have some major concerns about and feel that there needs to be reform in those areas.
Another example I just thought of is also the higher use of psychotropic medication, prescriptions for girls inside of facilities compared to boys. And not just higher use, but multiple medications. As well as the use of isolation, like solitary confinement.
And when we look at, we know girls come into the system with much higher rates of mental health issues. And so when the reaction is to place them in isolation, what we're doing is exacerbating the symptoms around mental illness and certainly not creating a therapeutic environment or a trauma-informed environment. One of the other things that we we heard about in the listening sessions, and certainly we've observed, is just staff insensitivity of calling girls names, of the language that they use in terms of talking with the girls. It really reinforces for girls their low self-worth, their low self-esteem, by having adults talking to them in that way. And there's general practices around strip searching, and there's rules inside of institutions that prohibit contact with siblings, who girls are very close when we think about their relationships and how girls center their lives around their relationships, and they're not able to see their siblings, and they're also not able to see their children if they're teen parents. And those are, as well, policies and practices that we think have to change.
Did any? I know you were very focused on the juvenile justice system. Was anything learned about placing girls in the adult facilities and differences on gender specific there? We've had many questions in the past about that. People, especially from states working to try to stop the practice.
Well, in the listening session, we didn't focus specifically on the adult system, but we would see major issues of placing girls inside of adult systems. At best, they're developmentally inappropriate, and at worst, what we see is that staff are not trained to deal with the issues that the adolescent girls bring into those facilities, and we see the re-traumatization, the re-victimization that takes place in those facilities. And it's just magnified when you put girls in those adult settings.
Right. Or in some cases, in some detention facilities that are being not funded anymore, where girls are now placed in facilities with boys in like a detention facility or in the adult jail. They're in a separate quarter, but they're now in an adult jail.
All right, so let's talk about now the other side of the coin. What are some emerging or promising or best practices around the country to assist in the prevention intervention of girls' delinquency?
Well, there are a number of positive things happening across the country, and I'm going to ask Vanessa to talk about what's happening in Stanislaus County, California.
So over the last year and a half, I guess, almost now, Stanislaus is in Modesto, California, and they have embarked on bringing together a community task force and have done a local needs assessment to really try to improve services and outcomes for girls involved in the juvenile justice system. And they kind of have a multi-layer project where they have a task force that develops a strategic plan, and that strategic plan really guides their funding priorities. And from there, they've pretty much developed, they now have a gender-specific drug court. They have a pilot intervention, which is an all-girl probation caseload that is meant to divert girls who would otherwise violate probation, who are now on it's called the grad program. And they also are going to be starting a mentoring program for girls inside of detention facilities. And they also have funded staff training, gender responsive training, for probation and the courts and court staff, as well as some of the local service providers. So they're really trying to do that multi-systemic change, and it's nice to see. We are actually working with them to do a process and outcome evaluation of their project.
And while that's happening in California, in Florida, in Duval County, there is the Justice for Girls Duval County Initiative, which is another community-based initiative that I think can be a model for other local communities, is being led by a group of citizens who are not involved in the juvenile justice system. And what they have done is looked at the research specific to that county to identify advocacy objectives as well as to develop a community-based continuum of services. And looking at the advocacy initiatives, they are looking at what are the policies and practices that are resulting in the disparate treatment of girls, some of those we've talked about already, the overuse of violations of probation, girls being arrested for less serious offenses and spending longer time in detention, and looking at the shackling issue and working to pass laws that would prohibit the shackling of girls who are pregnant and giving birth while incarcerated. And along with that advocacy agenda, there is also the development of a community-based continuum of care. And they began by looking at primary prevention. And we are doing this, they're doing this in partnership with the NCCD Center for Girls and Young Women. And when we looked at the research in Duval County, one of the questions from the citizen leaders was, how does it start? How can we prevent this from happening to girls? And what we found through the research was about 850 girls in elementary school were being suspended out of school for behavioral issues. And when we know from the research that one of the highest risk factors for future involvement in the juvenile justice system is school failure, the citizen leaders, the leadership council, felt that the place that they wanted to start was addressing why it is that girls were being suspended and that people weren't looking at what are the root causes that these are girls in crisis. And so we created the Girl Matters It's Elementary Project, where we now have programs in the two schools with the highest rates of out-of-school suspension of elementary school-aged girls, where we're wrapping services around them based on their individualized needs, keeping them in school and addressing the issues in the context of their family early. And we're also developing other, looking at what points in the system where girls can be diverted. So that's another, I think, important community-based system approach that is positive and can be replicated across the country. We're also doing some work in Missouri, and Missouri is being very creative in terms of providing the gender-responsive training all across the state to detention workers, to probation officers, as well as their school personnel, et cetera. And they have developed with us some formal and informal conditions of probation that are, in fact, gender-responsive, and the judges have embraced those, and so that they are addressing some of those gender issues that are driving girls into the system. And I
can you give some examples of those?
Of some of the formal gender, and informal?
The probation, this gender-specific probation?
Well, one of the things, it's as simple as in working with the girls, having the judge will have them actually do some reading material and look at reading material that addresses some of the issues that brought them into the system, and then do reports back to their probation officer about what are some of the lessons that they're learning. They're also participating in, as part of their conditions of probation, some groups, the Savvy Sister groups that are skills building around addressing everything from safety to how girls communicate to healthy relationships as part of their conditions of probation. They work with the families, and each girl, one of the conditions of probation was really helping the girls to have a safe person to call in the event that she was going to run away from home. Because what we know for many girls who are on probation, they're in the home, abuse may be happening in the home, and that pathway for girls is running away from home, which was a violation of probation. And in working with setting up the conditions of probation, there was an agreement that with her family that everyone would agree on who's a safe person that she can call when there are stressors in the family that's leading to fighting in the family or where a girl might run away. So the probation officer and the caregivers or the family members agreed that rather than running away, she had this safe person that she could call, and then she would let the probation officer know that she was with the safe person. So those kind of things were very creative interventions to help stop the girls from running away and having the technical violations of probation.
Right. Is there anything either of you wanted to add on promising or best practices?
We were talking earlier about states that have passed legislation, and Connecticut is actually another state that has done some remarkable work around with federal funding around gender-specific programming and mandating that their programs get the training and looking at their outcomes as well. That's one to look at. And I'm also noticing, and I'm doing some exploratory research on looking at alternatives to domestic violence batteries and noticing little pockets here and there, including one in Ohio, but also like Reno, Nevada, of programs that are doing alternatives to detention for girls who are charged with domestic battery charges to keep them out of the system and actually provide services to her and her family.
Great. A couple questions. Early on, you had mentioned that the girls themselves, when it comes to resiliency, were saying that they view their family as a resource and that relationships are important. Were there other things that they indicated would help with their resiliency that you haven't mentioned?
They wanted transition skills. They wanted, and we would say, educational vocational programming that is traditional and non-traditional, the independent living. Their resilience, I think, is so critical to, because even when they were experiencing these life events, they still had goals. They still were able to talk about their future goals and had a plan for what they wanted to do. And they wanted help. And one of the things that they actually said was that what would be helpful was a format or a forum to be able to share stories with other girls who've been there and to hear from others who've been involved in the system and who have made it, to hear their stories of how they did it.
They also wanted to hear from women who had been in the system, and they asked for inspiring stories from women who had made it. And, you know, one of the quotes from the girls was, "I need to know that someone like me can make it." And so they were very concrete in wanting to have a gathering place, too, of where they could share their stories and their experiences and learn from other girls and from other women's life stories. Girls also ask for counseling. They ask for therapy. They ask for access to health care, which was another issue we haven't really touched on, but just access to physical health care with some of the issues that they're faced with. And we saw in our research girls had everything from hypertension to certainly a number of physical ailments, asthma, chronic problems that really weren't being addressed, so they needed access as well to health care.
Okay. Well, another question we had, I had mentioned that NCCD in the introduction had developed a gender-specific version, or you have developed a gender-specific version of the juvenile assessment intervention system. So are there examples that you can give about what that assessment, you know, up front would look like? What's different and gender-specific about it?
The JACE assessment is the juvenile assessment intervention system, and people can certainly go on the website and learn more about the JACE assessment, but we included questions around trauma, around relationships. We also looked at the girls' educational and vocational needs. We looked at certainly the issue around safety and the girls in the context of their environment and the family around safety.
Mm-hmm.
You recall some of the other indicators that we put in?
Yeah, motherhood and parenting. Basically what it is it enhanced needs assessment that, you know, provides more gender-specific interventions that are based on what we know are some of the pathways and profiles of girls in the juvenile justice system.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left. Want to hear what some of the future areas of work or reform pertaining to girls may be.
Well, first I want to acknowledge the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention in terms of launching the National Girls Institute. And as you had said earlier, the NCCD Center for Girls and Young Women has a cooperative agreement with OJJDP for this work that's happening around the country. So we're in the process of developing training and technical assistance, and we're providing that in local jurisdictions, for agencies, for states across the country. And I think that's an important direction that's really garnering national momentum. So we would encourage people to go to the National Girls Institute website, and it's just www.nationalgirlsinstitute.org. And part of the work moving forward is that we'll be developing standards of care for girls programming that can help guide organizations and agencies or jurisdictions that are really grappling with what are the components that are necessary in a gender-responsive program. And we are continuing through the NCCD Center for Girls and Young Women to do advocacy around passage of legislation that would require gender-responsive services and the allocation of adequate resources, because the resources to girls' programs have really been woefully inadequate over the years, and there is really a need for investing in community-based programs.
And we would call for states to reexamine their statutes and programs, to look at their policies and practices that may be that may not be gender responsive or re-traumatizing to girls, and as well as just the policies and practices, the sort of the system policies and practices that kind of push more girls into the system. The criminalization of status offenses and the overuse of commitments, and the fact that in many local communities there really aren't the community-based resources on the front end to get her the services when these issues start to arise.
And we would also call for providing alternatives to secure detention and this overuse of detention, particularly since the majority of girls do not pose a public safety threat, and in fact most girls are high need and low threat. So we need to provide alternatives to secure detention, and the direction that we also are advocating for and that we see happening through the National Girls Institute is a focus on staff training and development to help staff to really understand not only the pathways of girls into the system, but what are some of the effective interventions that are trauma-informed, that are gender-responsive, that are culturally competent, and that are really grounded in what girls tell us that they need and grounded in the lived experiences of girls and their families.
Yeah. And I would add to that too, because I think, you know, evaluation of programming and kind of revisiting this dialogue. Everyone says, you know, we need evidence-based practices. Well, you know, there really are no gender-responsive evidence-based practices, just by definition of what kind of research design that entails. So kind of, what is that? What is the common ground? What is the intersection between those two? And how can we move to kind of align and integrate those two concepts?
Great. Well, there's sort of a question here, and you're talking about evaluation, but I think this kind of steps back, and Vanessa, maybe since you're on the phone, you can be helpful for communities and states that are really just beginning to sort of assess their situation, though, and responses to girls. What are some suggested points of data collection where they should begin?
Well, actually, if they go on to the National Girls Institute website, we've pulled, and I can't remember what page it's on, but it's a resource for staff that says kind of looking at the data sets that are available. And if you go on to the Census of Juveniles and Residential Placement, you can look at a profile by state, and you can get all the data. Actually, 2010 is just out. You can look at a one-day snapshot, how many girls in the system, what are they arrested for, what are they incarcerated for, what is the breakdown by race, ethnicity. So to get a sense of that profile, and then there's lots of community data sets that are available too, the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System, Ad Health, just to kind of get a sense of the community level data as well. I know that some states have pulled together these profile reports. We did that for Florida with the Rallying Cry study, and just kind of to show us what are the contributing factors. Or just talk to girls, have a listening session, go into a program, conduct a focus group, and ask them, you know, what are some of the pathways? How did you get here? And tell your story. But we would recommend doing that in a very, very safe space to really try to understand that the context for which these circumstances happen.
Well, I was going to say, I think
it's really important to look at the data sets that exist in your public school system and look at why girls are being suspended, why they're being expelled, what are the infractions that are happening inside of the school system, since we know that uneven grades, school failures, school suspensions are a major risk factor for later involvement in the juvenile justice system, and it's a significant pathway for girls.
And I was just going to encourage everyone to contact the Center for Girls and Young Women if they have specific questions and even want help, but maybe on setting up a listening session. It sounds like you could offer a lot of guidance around that. Are there other resources that you wanted to mention? We did put a few things up, like a summary of the listening sessions and fact sheets on the Children's Law website that's attached to the show, and that website is childrenslawky.org, but wanted to make sure there was nothing else you wanted to point listeners to.
Well, I would just reemphasize again the www.justiceforallgirls.org, www.nationalgirlsinstitute.org, as well as the nccdglobal.org website. So all of those, they'll be able to find resources and research and information specific to girls. And it also has our contact information, so we would be happy to support the listeners in any way that we can.
And Melinda, do you want to say on an individual level what folks can do? I mean, certainly there's the evaluation and the system and the data, but...
Oh, definitely. We have about 3 more minutes if you want to... I mean, that might be something also to put into some final comments, because there are people listening who definitely want to know what they can do.
Well, we would encourage you on an individual level to volunteer or support the programs in your community that's providing services to girls, mentor a girl in your neighborhood, at your church, at a local school, to get involved in that way, and to share your stories, to invite girls to job shadow so that they can be introduced to traditional and non-traditional career opportunities, and to organize and help to advocate for whatever the policy changes that need to happen that are specific in your state.
Other final thoughts that you want to share?
I just think it's really important to be able to use the data, your specific profile for your community, because it may look different from others, to use that information to seek funding to really be able to provide the services for your girls, and to use that data and information to inform decision-making and policies.
And as you are looking at that profile and really understanding who the girls are in your community, it's imperative that you include the voices of girls and let them be a part of this and include their life stories and their voices and their leadership.
Well, Dr. Wafora and Vanessa, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing the important work that you're doing. We really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Our next episode will feature James Bell, founder and director of the W. Haywood Burns Institute, and Antoinette Cavanaugh, forensic clinical psychologist. They will discuss the overrepresentation of youth of color in the juvenile justice system. So to stay informed about this and other upcoming shows, you can follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit Children's Law Center's website. So take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thank you both very much again. Maybe we'll have you on soon, I hope.
Thank you.
Thank you.